Good morning and welcome. Today, we return to the controversy of the state papers and the hunger strikers with journalist Eamon Malley, historian Eamon Phoenix, and former Sinn Féin press officer and author Danny Morrison. Now, we are moving on towards the state papers again, because you may remember we discussed earlier in the week the release of state papers both in Dublin and in London, and it gave rise to some controversy, I suppose reignited controversies that had existed before. We're going to start this by listening to the voice of Owen Caron, who was the election agent for Bobby Sands, giving the oration at the funeral of the hunger striker in Belfast in 1981.
I have no doubt that the name of Bobby Sands will mark a watershed in Irish history and will be a turning point in the struggle for Irish freedom. Bobby Sands will be remembered by freedom-loving people throughout the world as a freedom fighter and a political prisoner hungering for justice.
Now, I'm joined in studio by journalist Eamon Malley, who covered the hunger strikes at the time, and we'll be joined shortly from our Belfast studio by Danny Morrison, who was among a small group of Sinn Féin officers who liaised with the May's prisoners, and also we'll be joined from Belfast by historian Eamon Phoenix. But first of all, Eamon, you covered all of this as a very young journalist at the time. It's so many years on. How vividly do you recall the period, and are your recollections in any way at odds with what has been revealed in the state papers?
Well, there will be, and there is, considerable controversy around a number of particular issues, particularly the visit by Father McGee, who later became Bishop McGee, the Pope's representative. And I am a bit bewildered by what is reported in those papers vis-a-vis what allegedly Father McGee actually told the NIO, etc., because nothing that Cardinal O'Fee, and I spent a long time when I was researching with Cardinal O'Fee, and we went through the whole sequence and his whole visits and his meetings with Margaret Thatcher and everything, and he certainly didn't alert me to these claims which are now attributed to Father McGee. Well, basically that a deal was capable of resolution. He didn't alert me to that.
Effectively, Father McGee came with a message from the Pope, isn't that so?
Yeah.
Asking Bobby Sands to come off his hunger strike.
Well, there's a controversy here. There's one thesis that it was merely a pastoral visit. And then there's this other thesis that a deal, they thought there was a deal in the making, etc., etc. But there's some confusion, though. I've seen Eamon Phoenix's interpretation and that type of thing, and it seems to, I think Eamon Phoenix seems to be leaving it open to interpretation. But all I'm saying is nothing known to me that I heard around that time backs up what is in the state papers about Father McGee's role.
All right, well, Eamon Phoenix is in the Belfast studio. Eamon, good morning.
Good morning, Pat.
Now, just remind us of the sequence of events as described by the state papers.
As regards the Father McGee
yes.
visit, you mean, basically.
Yeah.
Well, of course, it's the end of April, a few days before Bobby Sands' death, and he arrives as a papal envoy. He pays about four visits to four hunger strikers in the maze, including Bobby Sands and Patsy O'Hara. There is a claim by Humphrey Atkins in the Prems coming from London that Bobby Sands offered to end his fast for 5 days on certain conditions, that advances would be made in terms of prisoners' right to wear their own clothes, association, and these various issues that had been around really from the previous hunger strike. This is rejected by Atkins, they can't surrender and so on, but this sits very uneasily with another report, which seems to have a ring of truth about it, which was basically a debriefing of Father McGee as he left Heathrow Airport a day or two later for Rome, and he's sitting with a civil servant, Michael Moriarty, from the NIO, a very senior official who's fingerprints are all over these documents. And in the course of 2 hours waiting for planes, Father McGee opens up and talks about the hunger strike. He doesn't mention Bobby Sands' offer, extraordinarily, to end his hunger strike. And he says that while Bobby Sands may die, he doesn't believe all the hunger strikers will die, and he feels he had a particular impression, or made a particular impression, on Patsy O'Hara, who does die subsequently. So I think There seems to be a sort of a contradiction between these two reports. So Atkins' claim of Bobby Sands' offer to stop, and the fact that Father McGee doesn't mention it. And indeed, the civil servant is very taken with him by his demeanour and so on, and very sympathetic. And I think that that seems to be the more convincing report.
Let's just hear, before I go back to Eamon Malley and Danny Morrison's in Belfast as well, this is Humphrey Atkins.
No. The British government's position has been made clear repeatedly by me, in speeches, in statements, and in the House of Commons, and has been reinforced by every other minister of the British government who has spoken about the subject. And our position is perfectly clear, everybody knows it, and that is where we stand. There is a way out of it, of course, and that is for Bobby Sands to give up his hunger strike. And the matter is entirely in Bobby Sands' hands. I hope he will choose to give up his hunger strike, but if he doesn't, he will die.
Eamon Malley.
Yeah, you know, one of my most reliable and probably one of the most academic sources on all of this research period was Pat McGowan, who himself saw everything evolve inside the jail. Now, he had quite a brilliant, brilliant recall, Pat McGowan. He's now dead, unfortunately. And, you know, he didn't exaggerate anything. He was very, very big on painting the picture. The Sands didn't want the second hunger strike to start as quickly as it started, etc. And you get the impression from Pat McGowan that, contrary to what's reported in some of these papers, the control really was inside, not outside the jail. And secondly, I just want to make this point, Pat. I spent a long time with David Gilliland, who was the Director of Communications during the hunger strike in the Northern Ireland office. Now, he was on the committee which dealt specifically with Atkins' hunger strike committee in the NIO. And he told me, and this again is at variance with an awful lot of the propaganda which came out of the time, Mrs. Thatcher detested the abuse she was getting internationally. Mm-hmm. And she wanted a settlement. She wanted to do something to bring about a solution to the problem. And in fact, Gilliland told me this. He said, the NIO committee at Parliament Buildings at Stormont warned Downing Street that should Mrs. Thatcher give way, that there would be mutiny within that committee, because at that stage, he said, if she bowed the knee, the IRA forever would run the jails in Northern Ireland. Now, he was very specific, and I'd be very interested in seeing Gilliland's papers, because I haven't seen this written or heard it anywhere. But he told me in the Wellington Park, he came to meet me when I was researching, and he told me that very specifically.
Danny Morrison, you were dealing with Gilliland, were you?
Well, I only met Gilliland once, actually. I never actually spoke to him. But what Eamon is saying there tallies with my impression of that period. Certainly, Thatcher was getting a lot of abuse, and Britain's name was mud around the world as a result of what was happening in the prisons. But she wasn't prepared, finally, in my opinion, to pay the price that was necessary to end it. And she took the advice of Humphrey Atkins and the prisons minister, Michael Allison, and the NIO. And the reason why I say what Eamon says tallies with my opinion is because eventually, and this is like 2 months after John McGee's visit and four deaths, when I am allowed into the jail, and I had been banned from the jail the previous December, I'm allowed into the jail on Sunday the 5th of July. It had been cleared by a person we now believe to be Michael Oatley, who was codenamed the Mountain Climber, and he was an MI6 agent attached to the Foreign Office. And of course it was the Foreign Office that was lobbying most actively for a resolution of the hunger strike. But when I went into the jail, some of the prison officers who saw me were quite abusive and were saying this was a sellout. And I went into the prison, met the hunger strikers. Separately, I met Brendan McFarlane. I told him that the message we were getting through, I didn't know Brendan Duddy's identity at the time, although I had met him but hadn't known him as Brendan Duddy.
He was known as Soon. That was the codename.
This is the codename for the British codename for this Derry businessman who was acting as a mediator. And I explained to him that I had been, we were in contact with the British. There was a confused and unclear what they were saying, except they were talking about prisoners getting their own clothes, letters, monthly visits, etc. And then I was allowed to phone outside to Gerry Adams to tell him the demeanour of the hunger strikers. And their position was that, first of all, they wanted their five demands. Secondly, regardless of what the British were offering, be it one or two demands, they wanted some mechanism for that to be guaranteed. And it was always that issue over the guarantee that the British balked at the idea of entering into a relationship with the prisoners where they could not resail from whatever was on offer. But I was then thrown out of the prison. Deputy Governor John Pepper came into the jail, ordered me out, and I said, I am in here with some authority to try and resolve this hunger strike. You just get out of this jail. And the very prison officers who were angry when I came into the jail were now gloating and very smug. So that was evidence of what Eamon is saying, that there were differences inside the British administration. There was pragmatists, and there were other people who were very, very hostile to the prisoners and pro-unionist, I would say.
You have a tale to tell about Gilliland and the United States. And
yeah. Well, it involves Danny Morrison, because Gilliland told me this story himself. He was a wonderful source, a very good recall, David Gilliland. And I should draw attention to a doctor with whom I spoke at that time, Pat. I'll come back to that if we have time, who actually monitored, who actually administered to the dying people. But David Gilliland said that he and Michael Allison, they flew to the United States, and they prepared flyers to put on the desk of every congressman and every senator on Capitol Hill. And they drew up and portrayed and painted the worst light, the hunger strikers, in the worst light conceivable, accusing them of being terrorists, abusers, all the rest, etc., wrongdoers, felons, everything. And Gilliland said they went into the various offices on Capitol Hill only to discover a corresponding flyer from Danny Morrison painting and portraying these people as noble Irishmen, heroes, etc. And Gilliland said to me, when I saw this on the desks in Capitol Hill, I just said, well, bully for you, Danny. So, and that was the propaganda battle. There was a daily battle between Republicans and the NIO, and it went on and on and on.
I'll come back to you on the doctor in a moment, but Eamon Phoenix, the whole question of reconciling different people's recall and the official versions as contained in both the Dublin and London papers.
Yes, indeed, this is always a problem for the historian. I mean, clearly, officials write with a view to history very often, and officials as well. But as I say, looking at the document, there's a fairly clear feed. I think Danny Morrison's absolutely right. You have a more complaisant Foreign Office, which is aware of the international picture, the Four Horsemen, pressure from the French Socialist government. Within Britain, pressure from people like Cardinal Hume, who talk about Britain's dismal record and that the fact that the Mays prisoner is different. You have all of that pressure mounting up. On the other hand, you have the NIO. You have Humphrey Atkins and Michael Allison, the prisons minister, who are right-wing Tories. I mean, during that long weekend that Danny's talking about, when he was trying to cut a deal, Allison and Atkins are counselling against it, stand firm, hoping that the provisional leadership, as Atkins puts it, to Thatcher, will be humiliated. So you have that tension between Lord Carrington and the Foreign Office, who want a larger kind of settlement of the Anglo-Irish question and the kind of unionist instincts of Margaret Thatcher. And the fact that she minimises, in her own hand, the offer being made to the prisoners in the H block, I mean, she minimises, apart from own clothes, which was virtually a given by that stage, she minimises everything else and says that, the prison authorities must have the final say. You get the impression that she realises in her head that a deal has to be cut because, if nothing else, the international sort of opprobrium which Britain is facing, but her unionist and anti-republican instincts are stronger.
And we know that change came about with the appointment of Jim Pryor. We'll come to that a little bit later on. One of the most controversial pieces to come out of these papers is the story on Raymond McCreesh, and we'll deal with that after this break.